Blog Talk Radio.
Once again, after a brief hiatus for the holiday break, for the worst 90 minutes in sports history. That's right, it's the Two Guys Soccer Show, and every time we think we reach a new low, we just dig that much deeper. Unfortunately, Stead is a little bit under the weather today, but that's all right. I found somebody who can fill in for him. Mr. Will, are you there?
Yes, I am here, and I'm ready to make this an even worse 90 minutes than normal.
That's saying a lot, because we have succeeded in making this a really, really, really epically awful 90 minutes. But at least we all have goals. So, as always, we are brought to you by the fine folks at Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland, Maryland's premier venue for live sports and entertainment, and the home of the Premier League in Montgomery County. So, unfortunately, we want to start the show. We have to start today's show off with a slightly sad note. I'm sad to announce that one of our only listeners, and he only does this on occasion, one of our only listeners, dear mother, Molly Montgomery, passed away. So our condolences go out to Sean on the passing of his mother, Molly. She was she died at 82. She was a diehard Gooners fan. Don't you know, Will, she waited until the day after Arsenal beat Man United to go.
Well, you know, she decided to get out on a high note in an otherwise kind of a dull season for them.
Yeah, so our thoughts and prayers go out to Sean and his family as they go through this. I've been in touch with him, and he seems to be holding on all right. I'm sure that last victory at least sent her off on a high note. So, I also want to announce a new sponsor, British Will's Brewing Company. 50% of the people who don't die after drinking it actually enjoy his beer.
Well, I think I've only had one person actually purchase some, and they still haven't taken delivery, so... You know, who knows?
So there you go. 50% of people who don't die after drinking your beer actually enjoy it.
Well, of course.
Good stuff. So how have you been, sir? How was your break?
Well, my break has been relatively uneventful. I, as you know, work for my university, which means I do nothing. And that's what I've been doing for the last week. I've been doing nothing apart from sitting in my room and watching some pretty interesting matches go on. One of which I think I'll start us off with, was the fiasco that was the Spanish Super Cup in Saudi Arabia. I thought that was a very interesting watch. And I want to get your thoughts on this riveting 0-0 derby between Atletico Madrid and Real Madrid.
I will not lie. I did not watch it live. I endured the replay, which is to say that I fast-forwarded through most of it. I thought the whole entire thing was a bit of a fiasco. The Spanish Super Cup is kind of that. It used to be the preseason tournament the preseason game before the La Liga season between the champions of the league and the champions of the Copa del Rey, sort of kind of like, well, almost exactly like the Spanish version of the Community Shield. And you know how much attention we pay to that game when neither one of our teams are playing in it. But the Spanish, La Liga, the Spanish FA saw an opportunity to make a cool £120 million over the next 3 years. So they shipped it, they turned it into a 4-team tournament, and shipped it off to Saudi Arabia and moved it from the beginning of the season to the middle of the season in between, before they start up again for the spring term. So hence why you had Valencia, Atletico Madrid, Barcelona, and Real Madrid. And this turned into a fiasco in more ways than one. You had a ridiculous red card, you had penalties, and a coach getting fired as a result. All not in the same game. But that 0-0 draw was, the game itself was kind of dour until about the 115th minute of a 90-minute game when Fede Valverde launched in on the Atletico Madrid, Alvaro Morata, who was clean through on goal with a chance to finally win it, well, extra time, and took the red card for the denial of a goal-scoring opportunity. Real Madrid went on to win it 4-1 in penalties, and the rest, as they say, is history. Zinedine Zidane is now 9-for-9 in finals that he has competed in as coach. Sorry. But
yeah, I think that sort of summary of the game is about as good as you can get. I was watching it live, and I fell asleep. It doesn't happen very often, but, I mean, it happens more often than not when I'm watching Atletico Madrid, because that game was a quintessential Diego Simeone sitting back and absorbing about 10 yards outside of his penalty area for 120 minutes, apart from one pretty good counterattack and Real Madrid not taking advantage of any of the opportunities they made themselves. As you mentioned, the Valverde tackle, I have one friend who is a very big fan of Fede Valverde, and he may or may not have called me after the game and talked about how he's completely off Rodrigo as his best hope for Real Madrid, and is on to Fede Valverde. And I was saying, yeah, but I mean, I understand what he did was the right thing to do, but it just sort of felt cheap, and it felt wrong, and it felt like Luis Suarez in 2010 on the line, stopping the ball and stopping Ghana from going through to the World Cup finals, semifinals. That's what it felt like to me.
It does, and it feels cheap. It feels cheesy. It feels like it's not sporting. It feels like it's everything. It's, you know, Woody Hayes sticking his foot out and tripping the guy as he's running in for a touchdown to try and stop him. Except, well, that was really not within the laws of the game. It's not exactly the sporting way to do it, but if you take Jose Mourinho's mantra that finals aren't meant to be played, they're meant to be won, you do what you can in a knockout game to get by. You do what you need to do to win. And he figured it was better to take the red card and play the last 5 minutes with 10 men and hope that they could win it in penalties, because I truly believe that's how Diego Simeone feels like he can beat Real Madrid in the final. Remember, he's had now 3 cracks at it, and he's taken them to extra time and penalties on each occasion. Twice he went to extra time, once he went to penalties, and he's lost all 3. Once he went to extra time, twice he's gone to penalties, and he's lost all 3. I think Diego Simeone is steaming right now as to figuring out how can he beat Real Madrid in whatever iteration they throw at him. And this might have been, you know, but for that play, the best chance that he had. I find it quite cynical that after the tackle, Fede Valverde gets awarded man of the match.
I mean, it was the man of the match moment. I mean, you saw what Simeone said after the match. He basically said what Valverde did won Real Madrid the game, and I have to agree with that. And since it's Diego Simeone, and he would probably instruct his players to do this himself, he said, you know, I completely respect the fact that he won man of the match. One person who might be feeling a bit snubbed is someone who got a lot of hate at the start of the season, which was Courtois, because throughout the match, while Atletico Madrid didn't really threaten, after that red card, Courtois made some pretty good saves to keep Real Madrid in it for the final, for the penalty shootout. And then he made a couple saves in the penalty shootout. But I think the penalty shootout was probably dictated by Saul missing the first penalty for Atletico.
Once you miss the first penalty, it puts you in a hole. And they never got back out of it because they missed their first three. And
yeah.
It wasn't until they got the third. By then, you know, you were asking, you were living on a wing and a prayer, hoping to get that in. You know, full credit to Atletico for what they did. You know, I think they expended a lot of energy just overcoming Barcelona. Remember, they were down 2-1, and they turned that around to win that game 3-2 in like the last 10 minutes of it. So that was a big one. And that ends up, as we said, that kind of ends up costing another Valverde in Ernesto a spot on the pitch as well. So I guess you could say two Valverdes go to Saudi Arabia and neither of them are going to be on the pitch next week.
I mean, this is true. And I guess that sort of goes into the new Barcelona manager situation. It was announced earlier today that Barcelona have a new manager in Quique Setién. I don't know if that's the proper way to pronounce his last name.
Setién.
I don't really, unless he's, I'm not certain, I don't think he's the interim manager that they've appointed. I think that he's been appointed as the proper manager. And he left Real Betis at the end of last season, and he didn't really leave them with the best of records. And that's his largest job up until this point. So I don't know if Barcelona has really replaced Valverde with a better option, so to say.
I think
they've replaced him with a new idea, but I don't think they've replaced him with a long-term option.
He was a guy that was rumored to be in the running for the job in January of last year. You know, he took Las Palmas out of relegation zone and to 11th. In his first season in La Liga, and then left in 2017. And then he took over Real Betis, took them to sixth place, and qualified for the group stages of the Europa League, and then left. He doesn't exactly have the resume that would suggest that Barcelona, that would make him a logical choice for Barcelona, but I feel very, very much like Barcelona are in a weird sort of crisis. Some of it is of their own making. You know, now we have essentially said that winning La Liga 2 years in a row, like Valverde did, is simply not good enough because everybody's calling for his head because they lost the Copa del Rey final last year to Valencia. They have, in the last 2 years, gone out in the Champions League in the earlier rounds in somewhat embarrassing fashion, collapsing both to Roma and to Liverpool last year, or Tottenham last year. It was you guys, Liverpool.
No, they lost to Liverpool. They lost 4-0 to Liverpool at Anfield, which is probably one of their most embarrassing games in their history.
Yes, and the way that they collapsed in each of the last 2 years was just not enough. Now, they had approached Xavi about taking over the job, possibly in May. But he turned it down because he doesn't respect the current board. And he's waiting for the new board to be elected, which will take place in, I believe, 2 years. So he's holding out for that. Now, a lot can change in that time. It would be hard, you know, Massimo Allegri and Mauricio Pochettino were both mentioned as potential candidates for this job, but I really think it's hard for anybody outside of Spain, and even harder for anybody who's not intimately familiar with the Real Madrid system to go in and take that job. You know, we saw what happened to Tata Martino when he tried to take that job, and he lasted a season and it was miserable. And even though they were winning, it was just a miserable experience for him, and the fans were unhappy, mostly because he just wasn't playing Barcelona football. If there is a club that identity is defined by how they play on the pitch, any more so than Barcelona, I'm really not 100% sure who it is. You're supposed to line up in a 4-3-3 formation with the El Tridente. You're supposed to play the tiki-taka style of total football. And I don't see where Pochettino or somebody like Allegri would be able to come in and pick that up, because they would want to do what they would want to do, and it's just not there for them. Plus, there is the specter of the mini maestro. You know, you've got to be able to deal with Lionel Messi. And in fact, I'm pretty sure that Lionel Messi was brought in on the decision of who the next coach is, because he carries perhaps arguably more weight than a player should at that club. And even though he doesn't talk much and he's not really, you know, he's not a guy who speaks a lot publicly and throws his weight around in public, you know that behind the scenes he's very much in on the moves that are made. And moves don't often get made without his blessing. So it's a very interesting situation. I do believe, like you do, that it seems like a short-term fix, because I don't know where Kike Setien's qualifications make him destined to be successful. But then again, who knew that Zinedine Zidane was going to be any good when he took over?
I mean, no one really thought that Zidane would be any good when he took over, but Zidane is going into went into a lot better of a situation with Real Madrid than Setien has gone into with Barcelona. Because Barcelona, yes, they've won the league for 2 years in a row, but they've also said we aren't the team, and the fans and the board obviously has said we aren't happy with the way that we won the league, and we aren't happy with the fact that for the past 2 years we've been it's been pretty much impossible for us to win a final. Because I think for the Copa del Rey 2 years ago, I'm not certain if they won the Copa del Rey 2 years ago, but if you just win the league for Barcelona, Barcelona did win in the 17-18 season. But if you just win the league and the league cup for the Spanish league, that's not really good enough for a team like Barcelona with a player like Messi. Because Barcelona is consistently ranked as one of the best, if not the best team in the world. And it's not really acceptable that the last time that Barcelona won the Champions League with Messi in their team, with Suarez in their team, and with the team that they currently have, the last time they won it was in 2015. I don't think it's acceptable in their eyes. And you saw that with what Messi said before the Champions League last year. Messi said before the Champions League, we'll win the Champions League this year. That is our promise to you.
The other problem is not that Barcelona hasn't won the Champions League. It's that Real Madrid has. In that span, since Barcelona last won a Champions League, Real Madrid won three. And then let's remember that they won the one before Barcelona won their last one. So you have the added problem that while Barcelona hasn't been winning Champions League and hasn't been making it to the finals, Real Madrid has, aside from last year. Now, I agree insofar as this team that he's taking over is not the team that last won the Champions League. They have never found an adequate replacement for Xavi or Iniesta. And look, replacing those two guys is going to be nigh on impossible. They're legends. They're all-time greats, right? And finding two players to come into that midfield who hadn't come up through that system the way that they had is going to be nigh on impossible. You know, the style, the intricate passing, what you have to be able to see to play that position. It's like asking Bill Belichick to go out and find another quarterback to replace Tom Brady, who's as good as Tom Brady. It's just not likely going to happen. At the same time, you know, they've never, you know, Pique getting older, you know, Messi getting older, Suarez getting older, all the players in that team, Mascherano getting older, all of them are getting older, and they haven't been able to adequately replace them. They thought they had the next Messi and Neymar. He's now playing at, you know, at PSG. They haven't been able to develop Ousmane Dembele the way that they thought they have. Coutinho hasn't pushed on. You know, they're hurting for fresh blood. If not for the magic of Suarez and Messi, you know, even Antoine Griezmann hasn't exactly picked up stumps in the year that he's been there, and he's fit in. It's a tough place to go for, in the outside. If you're not brought up through La Masia, it's hard to get into that style of play. We've seen how many players have come from the outside and just struggled. I mean, who was the last player that they bought that came in and just fit in right away, having never played there before?
Luis Suarez.
Yeah.
And that was in 2014-15. So I see what you're saying, and I completely agree with the idea about Antoine Griezmann. And I have certain players that I have always thought are just I hate to use the word overrated, but are just overrated. And Antoine Griezmann and Eden Hazard are both players that I think are completely overrated, because I think that they were part of teams that required everything to go through them. And and for Griezmann, he was part of a team that fed him on the counterattack from being in a deep block the entire game.
Mm-hmm.
And Barcelona doesn't play that way. Barcelona plays in the build-up play, plays with the passing, plays with the intricate moves, plays with the entire team. So I can see why Antoine Griezmann did not fit in with Barcelona. I think one player that they've made a relatively risky but probably a good purchase with is De Jong. Because Ajax, in their one season where De Jong was playing with them in the Champions League, he looked as though he was part of a team that was willing to pass and move the ball and willing to run and work for it back. It wasn't entirely a Barcelona style, but it was in the same vein as the Johan Cruyff Barcelona.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those two players are both purchases that Barcelona has made. And I think that De Jong was a better purchase than Griezmann, even though Griezmann was probably the higher profile purchase.
I would agree, and I think that you're exactly right on the fact that De Jong, based on how Ajax played all the way up through from his academy days through his first team, has a lot more in common with what Barcelona does. So he goes into a situation where he already understands, in a way, what he's supposed to be doing. Now it's a matter of fine-tuning his positioning, learning to read the players, understanding what he's supposed to do, and how to read the midfield and the motion of the players in front of him. I liken the Antoine Griezmann situation to a basketball player who's played point guard or shooting guard his whole entire career, like a Jimmy Butler type player, who is always created with the ball in his hands, a Kobe Bryant type of player, who always creates shots with the ball in his hands, and the offense goes through him, and that's how he does it. And then he's asked to become a spot up 3-point shooter, and it's just foreign. It doesn't work for him. That's not the nature of his game. But he wanted to move. They wanted him. It made sense. He took the payday. He's on the team. He's playing with Messi. Now, what responsibility the coach bears to be able to change the plays to fit the player in, because I do believe that we can both agree that Antoine Griezmann, whether you think he's overrated or not, is still a pretty quality striker, and he would start on both sides of the world. How they can work him in. He bears some responsibility for figuring out how to play within that system.
I mean, I agree that Antoine Griezmann is a quality striker, and he has a position at striking position, but Barcelona doesn't need a striker. Well, I mean, they need a striker now because Luis Suarez is out injured, but at the time that Antoine Griezmann was bought, they didn't need a striker. They had what is considered to be one of the best number nines in the world. That one of the only other number nines that was considered better is a short man called Robert Lewandowski in the Bundesliga. But it was sort of a signing that didn't make sense to me. And it's kind of like when Liverpool fans are saying, oh, we want Mbappe 2020. We've got this new Nike hit deal, Mbappe 2020. We have a system that works without a number nine. And we have a system that works without a full out-and-out striker. We have Roberto Firmino playing as a deep-lying center forward. And I think that if we bought in a player like Mbappe, we wouldn't be able – well, I mean, we would be able to fit him in, but I think it would freeze out a player like Firmino that is so integral to our team. And I think that's what they did with Griezmann, and they didn't try and make it. They tried to put him out on the wing, didn't they, at the beginning of the season?
Well, they'd been playing him out on the wing, which was, and it reminded me at least initially a lot like when they had Samuel Eto'o and Ronaldinho, and they tried to sign Thierry Henry. And I remember watching Thierry Henry's warm-up game in New York. And Thierry Henry, who is as classic a striker as you can imagine, is playing out on the left wing, and he just looks lost in space because
I think
it's completely foreign to him.
I think something that I heard in the commentary of the game is commentary of the Aston Villa-Manchester City game yesterday, where Aston Villa got taken apart, and they were talking about El Mohamedi, who's generally a winger who gets put down the center. The commentator made a good point. Sometimes a winger who gets put down the center can play well out of position because it's such a novel new position that they have so much space to run into. But I don't think the same can be said for a striker put out on the wing. Because
you're
a striker put out on the wing doesn't have the qualities that a winger needs.
It depends a lot on what you see. Now more and more we see guys who are nominally strikers being shipped out the wing. Think about how many in the last couple of years you've seen. Anthony Martial, Marcus Rashford. Typical strikers who are being asked to play wing positions because people are almost lining up in that with a three-striker formation. Now, I'm not saying
that. But do you think that those players have been served by being asked to play on the wing, or do you think that they've been hampered? Especially in the case of Anthony Martial, I'd like to get your thoughts on that, because I know he's had a few injury problems, but until recently, he hasn't really been seen as fulfilling his potential at Manchester United. And I'd like to get your thoughts on that as a Manchester United fan.
I think that he was came in as a striker. He had the striker's mentality. He wanted to be a striker. When he was moved out to the wing, I think he didn't initially work as hard at learning that craft as, say, his counterpart in Marcus Rashford did. Now, I look at how Marcus Rashford is playing and how he can be effective now in both positions as a result of saying, okay, if this is what you want me to do, this is what I'm going to do. And he's just able to read the game and create space for himself more effectively. Now, in both cases, these were two young guys that were learning the game, and they were still learning to play the position, any position. I think Martial is going to benefit from being placed now in one position and allowed to develop that specific skill set. But as we go to more and more teams are looking at positionless attacks, you're going to see more cases of this. In each case, their inclination is one that they're running at goal, because these are not guys who stand there with their backs to the net. When they're running at goal, whether they're out on the wing or they're playing down through the center, their inclination is to go inside, which I think is counter to what we talk about when we talk about the classic winger who wants to get down to the end line and cross the ball over to create a chance. You know, think of the David Beckham mold, right? Ryan Giggs. These guys aren't that. And, no, you know, it's hard to find somebody like that anymore. You know, Raheem Sterling, Jadon Sancho aside, yeah, mostly a lot of these guys are, yeah.
I mean, they're all tied up at Manchester City right now.
basically. Yeah, I mean, not to say that you don't have two good ones at Liverpool.
I mean, yes, but they're more wingers that think as strikers now.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of.
But
based on the way that Liverpool is playing, I would say that Liverpool is playing not playing a classic 4-3-3 anymore. I'd say that they're playing a 4-3-1-2, where Roberto Firmino is playing as a center forward instead of a center attacking mid. And I think that the position that Roberto Firmino has made for himself at Liverpool is going to be a position that teams all around the world are going to start to try and develop. Because I think that it sort of solves this problem of wingers that are also strikers, but can cause a lot more problems for defenses if they cut inside. Because what Roberto Firmino does is he scores goals and he gets assists, but the work that he does right around the center circle and inside of Liverpool's own half is completely invaluable. He gets probably the same amount of touches in Liverpool's half, winning the ball back, as he does in the opposition's half. And I think that in the last couple of seasons, managers have started to realize just how helpful that has been for Klopp's growth at Liverpool. Because whenever you talk about a pundit talking about Liverpool now, Roberto Firmino's name is the one that comes up after the first superstar that they're talking about that week.
But the other thing about it, though, is you can want to develop that position as much as you can, but find me another person with Roberto Firmino's combination of size, speed, and agility.
I mean, he's an average-sized player, and he's not very, very fast. He just runs all game, and he runs at the
but
same
I,
speed
I'm
all game. I think that
there are guys
who
are faster, there are guys who are bigger, but there is not anybody with that exact skill set that he has.
Oh, I completely agree, and I think that Roberto Firmino has pioneered the position, but I think it's something that academies will start looking at to try and develop, because it's just been shown how completely dominant it is against either a team that plays in the passing style of your 4-3-3s or a team that just sits back and defends. Because
mm-hmm.
he is on
it
you
breaks
the
open
entire
the
game.
It breaks open the game. And it also helps that you have two lightning quick wingers and who can score, and Sadio Mane and Mo Salah. And you have a player like Roberto Firmino who realizes that as many goals as he's going to score, the team's success is not predicated on him being the goal hog. So he has to have that selfless nature, too, to realize, like, we are successful when our wingers score. There will be one of the only teams in the world whose wingers outscore their nominal center forward.
Well, yeah, I mean, their wingers have outscored their nominal center forward for the past three seasons. So, I mean, I don't know. I think that because we were planning on talking a bit about Liverpool's title run this season. Well, not title run, like run in the league this season.
Well, I had this whole entire thing about how the world, you know, everything stays the same despite the fact that it's 2020 and the world still turns. Liverpool still wins. Arsenal and Man United still don't. And Jose Mourinho is still Jose Mourinho.
I mean, the thing that annoys me most as a Liverpool fan when people talk about Liverpool's season this season is the fact that people are saying that the Premier League this season is the least competitive it's ever been. And it's because the teams are the worst that they've ever been in the Premier League. And I think that that's kind of just wrong on so many levels and just also completely unbacked up by the monetary value that's in the Premier League right now. I think it's probably the most difficult league that it's been in its history right at this current point in time. It might not be the most competitive league in its history, but I think it's probably the most difficult it's been in its history, just simply based on the amount of money that even the bottom clubs get from the new television deal. Well, not the new television deal anymore, the current television deal with NBC.
I think that a lot of people make it an either-or dichotomy that it doesn't have to be. And to really appreciate it, you have to take a step back. Liverpool is dominant. They've gone a calendar year. They've gone two full rotations through the 18 teams that are playing in the Premier League without losing a game. That is historic, right? They have a 14-point lead with a game in hand. They would have to lose. Manchester City would have to win every game, and they would have to lose six for them to lose the Premier League. They're going to win. The title is decided.
We don't know if they're going to win yet. We won't know until the end of March, when it's mathematically impossible.
Possible.
If we win every game.
we can start to look at them as the champions elect. They are on a historical run. At the same time, the Premier League is basically a case of one dominant team, two pretty good teams, and about 10 other teams that are trying and not succeeding. Have Liverpool benefited in this run from playing a Premier League that is not as top-heavy as some of the previous iterations? Yes. Would they still be where they were right now, even if you had that caliber of team in the Premier League besides them? I would argue, yeah, they may not be on the historic pace that they are, but this team is that good that they would still be a league-leading dominant team. So I think it's a fallacy to say that the reason that Liverpool is where they are at the top of the league is because the Premier League is so bad. I also think it's a mistake to say that part of Liverpool's dynamic point total to this point in the season is to discard the fact that the pace that they're on points-wise, like the record, is not in part due to the fact that their competition is down. It's also a fallacy.
I mean, if you look back, you'd have to say that this Liverpool team is completely historic because it's the top five leagues record is this 61 mm-hmm. points at this point in the season. Mm-hmm. And that's taking into account France is considered a top five league.
Mm-hmm.
And I stay with PSG playing in France, where PSG buys the league every year. They purchase it from the from Uber Eats every year now. So I think that, and we have to remember, early on in the season, Liverpool was considered to be, you know, not not playing very well and somehow managing to scrape by points. And I don't want to say the mentality monsters thing that everyone says around Liverpool at this point. I just think that it's more about the culture of winning that Liverpool has instilled in itself and the culture of trying. It's not so much that they think that they can win every game. I'm sure they think they can win every game. It's just they know that they can out-try every team. And you saw that in the sort of result against Barcelona at Anfield last year where they won 4-0 when no one expected them to win. The most diehard Liverpool fan had their fingers crossed and they wore their pajamas backwards and they said, you know, we're going to go out and we're going to try to win. We probably will just win the game. We probably won't go through. And Liverpool went through and they won. And I think that the games that Liverpool have just played, they've always just out-tried their opponents. I remember after the Barcelona game, there was a game where Liverpool beat Newcastle 3-2. And it looked as though Liverpool was going to lose this game. And then it looked as though Liverpool was going to draw this game. And then Liverpool tried extra hard in the very end of the game, and they won the game. And it kept us on pace to challenge for the title last year. We didn't win the title, but it kept them on pace to challenge for the title. And I think that this idea that Liverpool will outrun you in every game that you play is what has pushed them above this season. Because at about the 80-minute mark, Liverpool is normally still full of running and still attacking you. And that's the thing that scared me the most about the Liverpool's most recent game against Tottenham. At around the 80-minute mark, every Liverpool player just looked dead on their feet. You had your Jordan Henderson, who normally looks as though he can still sprint at 120 minutes. He looked as though he was just, every chance he got, he was walking. And every chance he got, he was had his hands on his knees and he was puffing for breath. And that's what scared me the most about the game. Although Liverpool won, it's sort of the point where I'm starting to think Liverpool might have a couple draws coming up in the next couple games because the team just looks very tired.
Well, they are going to drop points at some point this season.
Probably a foregone conclusion. I would hate to think about the points that are going to drop, but I think that there will be at least 2 points dropped in the rest of the season.
Well, I would guarantee there'll be more than 2 points. I bet right now that there'll be more than 2 points dropped in the rest of the season because what would only dropping 2 more points would put them where 104, 108 total, which is like unheard of, astronomical.
I believe if they drop 2 more points, it would put them at 110.
Yeah, like 110 is a lot. And I believe that as the season goes on, you know, Jurgen Klopp is pragmatic, if he's anything else. He knows that their season won't be determined by winning the Premier League with an astronomically high points total. It'll be remembered if he wins the Premier League and gets them back to the Champions League final. All right, so once he gets to, it's mathematically won, he's got his 101 points, he's got his 31 victories, I think he starts taking his foot off the gas, substituting a fair few players, because provided that they're still in the FA Cup, he has the opportunity to solidify himself as the manager of probably the greatest team in English history. If they go on to win the Premier League with a historic points total and they break the wins record, which is sitting at 31, points total would be, what, 102? Or 101.
No, it was 100. It was the Centurions.
Yeah. 101 and 31 gets him at the top of the record books for the Premier League. The only other thing that you could say would be if he wins the treble, then it kind of takes a lot of air out of the argument for is this the best English team ever?
I think I would have to agree with you. And although I don't know how many points a team with substituted players will drop, because you've seen Jurgen Klopp try to lose games this season and fail to lose games this season. He tried to lose the game against Arsenal in the League Cup, and he failed to lose that game because the rest of the players that he put in, the kids that he put in, was just basically told him, no, we're going to win this game. And then I wouldn't say he tried to lose the game against Everton, but he put in a team that everyone was saying, you know, hey, you know, Everton has a chance of beating this Liverpool team. I know Everton hasn't won since before 1999, but, you know, Everton has a chance of winning this game. And then Everton lost the game. So Jurgen Klopp, I think, puts an understanding in, I might be making a weaker team, what many would consider a weaker team selection to be, but I expect the same amount of effort from you, Harvey Elliott, as I would expect from Sadio Mane. And I
but that
think
was the same
that
thing with the, what? That was the same thing Sir Alex Ferguson used to do in his Man United heyday. He would go out and he'd put a weakened team out there in a game against an Aston Villa or something like
that.
Yeah, and he did. He once played a team with eight defenders against Arsenal in an FA Cup final match, and he still won. You know? So it happens. Before we go further, though, I do want to take a moment to give a shout-out to our sponsor, Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland. Maryland's premier venue for live sports and entertainment, and the only place to be this Sunday at 11:30 to watch the aforementioned Reds of Liverpool take on the Red Devils of Manchester United, the only team in the Premier League that has actually taken points off of Liverpool this entire season. So
I knew you were going to bring that up.
Somebody has
to. I knew you were going to bring up the fact that Manchester United is the only team to take points off of Liverpool.
Somebody has
to. You know, it's a fair point. But I think we should probably move on off of Liverpool, because as amazing as their title run is, it's going to keep going until March. And I think that something that you wanted to talk about was Harry Kane's injury, and something that
That does figure into a little bit about what happened this weekend when Liverpool beat Tottenham, and just how that team played and where Tottenham, where Spurs are going to be moving forward without Harry Kane and with Jose Mourinho as manager. Because I think what you saw this weekend, aside from a really good Liverpool performance and a team that gutted out a win, was Jose Mourinho, despite saying that he's reformed one, reverting back to his natural tendency, which is defend, 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 and hope that you can catch him on the counterattack. Again, looking lost when he doesn't have a big number nine on the pitch. And in this particular case, they're not going to get Harry Kane back. If you believe Jose Mourinho and the surgery, they're not going to get him back at any point this season. So is this Jose Mourinho shutting up shop and basically writing off Tottenham season and saying, okay, boys, see you next year? Is he going to pick and choose the games that he's going to try and compete in and hope that he can get them up somewhere in the neighborhood of the European places? I remember last year without Harry Kane, you know, Tottenham competed damn well, made it to the Champions League final without him in there. And now they can't play with Liverpool?
Well, I think that pitting them against the Liverpool team that we saw is a bit unfair because, again, it is this Liverpool team that is just better than just about everyone. I don't know that it will be Jose Mourinho reverting back to form because while they don't have a big number nine like he likes to work with, they do have two very potent attacking players in their team in Heung-min Song and Lucas Moura. And I thought that going back to the Champions League final last year, I thought that one of the biggest mistakes that Pochettino made was not playing Lucas Moura and playing Harry Kane, a still injured Harry Kane instead. So, as you said, Tottenham knows how to play without Harry Kane. One thing I will say about Tottenham, which I didn't really expect to be saying about Tottenham because it never really crossed my mind before, but they're a pretty aging team. So I think that there is the possibility that, Mourinho does shut up shop and say, look, this season we're going to do what Chelsea did. I think in, what was it? It was in the season that Leicester won the league in 2015-16. And basically say, look, we're happy with eighth place. We're just going to get through to eighth place, and we're not going to have any sort of European football next year. And next year, we're going to go on, and we're going to try and win the league. I think that might be something that Tottenham that has been discussed in the boardroom of Tottenham, and I think that it's something that is possibly the best way that Tottenham will go forward through the next couple of years, because Jose Mourinho knows how to win a trophy, and that's the biggest thing that Tottenham's been lacking in recent years. I think their last trophy was, what, the League Cup several years ago? So,
I think he may choose to focus his attentions now on the FA Cup, which is a trophy that he may feel like he can win with this team, even without Harry Kane in the lineup. But it's like right when it started, I can kind of feel like I know where this is going. I know how this is going to end with him, and this is how it starts. And, you know, until proven differently, I'm going to believe what my eyes have seen. And I don't discount Jose Mourinho. I thought for 2 years, Jose Mourinho was pretty doggone good manager at Manchester United. And I appreciated what he did. You know, the third year was a problem. And we'll see what happens when he gets the third year at Tottenham. But this is kind of Jose ball. And it was a classic Jose game where, you know, you defend, you clog up the midfield. He definitely has a plan to win that game. But what always frustrated me with him in those matches was he has a plan to win the game, but the margins are so thin. If you don't capitalize on that one, it's all about getting one or two chances. And if you don't capitalize on that one or two chance, and they did, Giovanni Lo Celso squandered it.
Well, they had two major chances in the second half.
Yeah, and if you don't capitalize on
Giovanni
those two
Lo
major
definitely
chances,
squandered one of them. But you know, they came as close as anyone's come since Manchester United in the first run through to taking points off Liverpool.
And
so,
again, I think that he had a plan, but the margins with Jose Mourinho, and this is just classic Jose in these games, the margins are always so fine that if you are not able to capitalize on that one or two chances that you get per game, the game goes down the tubes and you lose.
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree with that.
And I've seen it so many times. Now, when it works, it works. You know, I remember, what was it, the year it'll be 2 years ago now, when Manchester United beat Liverpool 2-0 off of a couple of Marcus Rashford goals in the first half.
Oh, yeah.
And he had a plan of how basically to just bypass the Liverpool midfield with the counterattack, and it worked perfectly. And they walked off winners 2-1. But again, a lot of that had to do with the fact that they got two opportunities early. Marcus Rashford put both of them away. And I don't know if they created another scoring opportunity the remainder of the game.
Well, I think the problem with Jose's plan against Liverpool was it wasn't implemented in the first half. If he'd done what he'd done in the second half in the first half, I think they'd have had a better chance of taking a point off this Liverpool team. That also being
said,
I think
he did exactly what he wanted to in the first half.
Which was
to slow
them
down and gum up the works. Because that's how he plays against
Liverpool.
It
didn't really look as though they'd been gummed up that much.
Or absorbed the pressure as much.
Yeah.
Remember, he's comfortable with a parked bus.
He's very comfortable with a parked bus, which is, you know, what everyone hates about him. I think that Firmino scoring in the first half sort of messed up the second half, which is why it came out in the second half that Tottenham tried a bit harder at the start of it, and then they tried to capitalize on the fact that Liverpool looked tired. They failed to capitalize on it. They failed to score their chances. But I think one of the telling things was, I don't think any of their players, when they had the ball, which was, I think they only had the ball up less than a third of the time. I think none of their players really tried to take on any of the Liverpool team. So I think that what you're saying about, you know, sitting back and parking the bus that Jose had in mind for this game and the plan of parking the bus is completely correct. But I think that, we're analyzing a game as though, I think that it's kind of pointless to analyze this game because it was classic Jose ball, as you said, and then Liverpool scored and they failed to capitalize on their chances.
But that's two that he's coached against, you know, what we would consider to be the typical top six, and Man United and Liverpool, and he's gotten beaten in both.
Yeah.
So,
and I mean,
and he's failed to score in either.
Yeah, and they have the FA Cup rematch coming up. So it'll be interesting to see what team he plays against Middlesbrough midweek. Tomorrow, isn't it? Yeah, tomorrow. It'll be interesting to see, because I think you might be right that he's possibly just going to go all in for the FA Cup.
If his mandate is to win a trophy, then that would be the easiest one conceivably for him to win because, you know, he can focus all of his attention. Of course, they're still in the Champions League, and we'll see them play in that. And it'll be interesting to see what he takes into Champions League because, you know, he's had his highs and lows in that tournament. You know, that was, of course, the tournament that made him. But he was not successful at Chelsea. He was successful at Inter Milan.
And he was successful at Porto.
At Porto. But he didn't pick it up at Real Madrid. And, you know, his last go-round in that tournament with Manchester United ended horribly. And that was when everybody started talking about the game had really passed him by. When they absolutely got taken apart by a Villarreal team or Valencia that they should have beaten easily. So it'll be interesting to see how he approaches that tournament. You know, in the Premier League, it's interesting because it's so congested.
Around the middle of the table.
Around the middle of the table. You know, I have talked with Sted about this, and when you talk about the three traditional powers that are having down seasons, and Arsenal, Manchester United and Tottenham as far back as October. I was saying,
yep.
You know, just the atmosphere around Manchester United feels a little bit more comfortable, despite the fact that the results are not there. The atmosphere feels more comfortable around them than it does either Tottenham or Arsenal at that point. I think the last couple of weeks have just solidified that point. Yes, Manchester United was awful against City, and they weren't great against Wolves, and they were pretty abject against Arsenal as well. But, you know, they ran out 4-0 winners against Norwich, which is really one of the first times that he's gone into a game against the bottom team and actually done what they were supposed to do. They're sitting fairly comfortable in
fifth place.
In fifth, right now. And regardless of the result against Liverpool on this weekend, they can't fall. I think at the lowest they could conceivably fall would be seventh. You know, Tottenham can't catch them this week. Neither can Arsenal. And to be honest, Arsenal doesn't look much like catching anybody right now. I know Sted's going to be upset to hear about that, but it, you know, Mikel Arteta has definitely not gotten the new manager bounce that I think they hoped that he would get.
Yeah.
And as much as this season, again, as I said to you before, as much of this season is going to be a referendum on Liverpool's dominance, it is going to be talked about in the same breath, the instability of the teams like Chelsea, Arsenal, Manchester United, and Tottenham, the traditional teams that have been competing over the course of the last 5 years, just how unstable and how mismanaged they have been to a certain point, to get to this point where they are find themselves in the situation that they're in now.
I mean, I think I'd have to – I definitely agree with you there. And I think that the atmosphere around, well, especially Arsenal this season, feels a lot like the atmosphere that I felt around Liverpool in the 2012-13 and 2014-15 season, especially. Because it just sort of feels as though Arsenal doesn't expect to win a game. And I think that that's what I felt when I was supporting Liverpool. When I was supporting Liverpool at that time, it didn't even feel as though I expected Liverpool to score more than once in a game. And I think that's what it feels like at Arsenal right now. And, you know, I think that another thing that's not really talked about enough about the instability of these teams is, I know that it's not really as big an issue for Chelsea right now as it was a couple weeks ago, but the fact that Chelsea isn't in a strong fourth place. Manchester United is still challenging Chelsea for fourth place. And when we talk about how the sort of the season that Manchester United has had, and we talk about it as, you know, one of the worst seasons they've had in years, you have to remember that this is considered to be one of Chelsea's comeback seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, Frank Lampard's, you know, masterclass, tactical masterclass, and he's, you know, they are 5 points ahead of Manchester United and they're 7 points ahead of Sheffield, but they're not a long way ahead of the pack that's chasing them.
But the fact that we are talking about Sheffield United being up there is a bit surprising. Yeah,
well,
I
think at the start of the season, I came on this podcast and I said, I think that Sheffield United has made some smart business over the summer and they have a pretty good chance of not being relegated. I didn't think they'd do quite as well as they said, but I thought they would be closer to top of the bottom half of the Premier League. So, yeah, I don't think it's completely out of nowhere that Sheffield came and they've done as well as they have. But I think
saying that they won't get relegated is way different than saying that they're going to be competing for Europe.
Well, my point was, I didn't think that Arsenal, Tottenham, and Manchester United would have as bad a season as they've had. And I didn't think I thought that in place of Sheffield United would be probably Arsenal at this point. That's what I thought at the start of the season. So Arsenal would be 10th, 11th in this league. And I think that quite a few people said, you know, Sheffield has a good chance of doing this.
Because I am surprised by Sheffield. I will not lie. That I would probably have put Arsenal or Chelsea in their place. I am a bit surprised by Leicester City, but should we be? I mean, this is a team that still has a Premier League title in their DNA, you know, and it didn't end well at Liverpool for Brendan Rodgers, but he still did have a fair few decent seasons, and I think his time in Scotland he used to his benefit. So he's just once again proving that he does know how to manage. And they are, to a certain extent, taking advantage of lesser competition.
I mean, they're taking advantage from a weakened league because I think they've lost 5 games this season as Leicester, and so have Manchester City. So, yeah, generally speaking, at this point in the Premier League, unless we're talking about the seasons where it was 80 points to win it, that's not where the second and third place teams are.
Yeah.
So,
and we're also, you got to be surprised at this point in the season that Man City has lost 5 games. Not necessarily that Leicester has, but that Man City had. I think is a bit of a surprise. And going
that,
back
that
to
is
what
a
we
bit
said.
Of a surprise.
You know,
especially their loss to Norwich early on in the season.
Yeah.
Because Norwich sitting rock bottom, where 3 of their 14 goals were scored against Manchester City.
Well, it goes back to what we talked about earlier in the season, where how long a leash...
Sorry, 45 goals.
Does,
I was wrong.
Yeah. How long a leash does Quique Setién have at Barcelona? Because, man, if Pep goes through his third season, and he doesn't normally manage beyond 3 seasons, at Manchester City without a trophy, does he just pull up stakes and go back to Barcelona?
I mean, that is a possibility.
It very much is. The only thing that he has said would be that he will retire before he'll manage Manchester United or Real Madrid.
I mean, currently Pep's contracted until 2021. And I think that if he doesn't win a single trophy this season, Manchester City isn't going to be looking to replace him because he is Pep Guardiola and they are Manchester City, so they can give him an open piggy bank, and he can buy all the players that he wants to buy, and then he'll come back next season and he'll sweep either the League Cup and the FA Cup and the Premier League again, or he'll just, you know, he'll win something next season.
Well, I think
so
the
I don't
big
know,
question,
they're
though,
not going
is...
to fire him over the summer, but I don't know that he will want to stay if he doesn't win anything.
I think that's the big one, is whether it's not a matter of them firing him. Because once you get rid of Pep Guardiola, where do you go?
I mean, you go to you look into the pool of managers that you have right now, which is probably the problem that Barcelona has right now. And you look and you're sort of going to go to Everton and say, "Can I have Carlo Ancelotti? I'll pay you £20 million."
We've seen where that goes. You know, and Pep's system is so based on him that unless you have been learning from him, it's hard to go in there and replicate it. Remember, I would say a lot of Barca's current situation is fact down to the fact that Pep's number two, Tito Villanova, they were flying high with Tito in Barcelona as manager. The problem was that he got sick and died.
Yeah.
So, you know, it kind of was after that, it was like, where do we go from here? There really isn't anybody else who knows what this man does. Look what happened after he left Bayern Munich. They slid backwards. Barcelona, they backtracked. I don't know if there's anybody who can go in. And the only way I would think to go in after Pep Guardiola is to have somebody who can come in and completely just clean house and say, I'm going to bring in a whole entire new system. Because
tactically, the way they're set up, the way he trained, see that happening over a summer is Manchester City, because they have unlimited money.
They have unlimited money, but they still operate inside the realms of reality. So they can go in and say, I'm going to bring in a whole entire new starting 11, but what are you going to do with the starting 11 that's there? Because the one thing that we've known is a lot of players go to Manchester United, of Manchester City, but it's often hard for them to get rid of players because they're on such high wages.
Well, I mean, they also have the money to just keep the players until the end of the contract and not renew them, like you saw with James Milner. James Milner was probably the best free contract signing in the last 5-10 years. Possibly one of the best pre-contracts. I'm not certain all the other ones, but he's been a brilliant pre-contract. And I think they just got rid of him on a free because they couldn't be bothered to find a team to replace, to buy him out. So they have the money to just not like let players go for free. And their big name signings, if they wanted to get rid of anyone, I think that they have shockers out there. You saw with Bayern Munich looking for Leroy Sané, and apparently they're still interested in Leroy Sané. So I think that
Leroy Sané, though, has sell-on value because he's relatively young, at early 20s. I'm thinking more of a person like a John Stones or a Aymeric Laporte, who may not necessarily have much of a sell-on value. You're right. They would probably, if they wanted to get rid of, have to eat and let walk for free.
I mean, John Stones is still pretty. I mean, he's not young, but he's only 25, and I think Laporte is 22.
I thought Laporte was a little older. They may still both be young, but who knows?
I think he's quite young. You know, he's also 25. So,
yeah.
You know, their two centre-backs are relatively young, especially for defenders. And I don't think that they would look to get rid of Laporte.
No. Stones more likely.
They probably
Otamendi,
look to get
definitely.
Rid of Stones. And Otamendi, I think that they'd just be willing to pay someone to get rid of them. But, you know, I think they might start doing what Barcelona did, and they send them out on loan saying, we'll pay half their wages if you take them off our hand, and then you have a contract to buy on.
Speaking
so what they did with Coutinho.
Well. Yeah. That's an interesting segue because that gives us an opportunity to wrap up the show by talking about the transfer market or lack thereof. We're almost halfway through the month and all the promised fireworks have yet to show up. Chelsea, fresh
hey, Liverpool.
Liverpool did make a signing, but we already knew
Liverpool's
that was coming.
Liverpool made a signing. They've made one of the largest signings they've made in the last year, and they brought in Takumi Minamino, which I like him, but I don't know if I buy into the whole hype behind him yet. But the only other transfer that I've seen is Gedson Fernandes from Benfica going on loan to Tottenham, and I don't even know if that's been confirmed.
Well, he had his physical today, so that's all but done. And Danny Drinkwater is on loan now at Aston Villa, and he was responsible for one of the six goals that he was directly responsible for two of the six goals they conceded to Manchester City.
Didn't he assist his teammate twice?
Yes. Just on the wrong team.
Yeah, his former teammate, I must say.
Yes, and Aston Villa also signed Pepe Reina, who
Pepe Reina's back in the Premier League. He's gonna do well.
But other than that, it's been a slow burn, and we were promised that Chelsea, fresh off of their transfer ban, they had a boatload of money to spend, and they were going to spend, and they have yet to. Manchester United is talking about bringing in another Fernandes from Portugal in Bruno Fernandes.
Bruno Fernandes. I've been reading
the story about that. Which is an interesting one because you're going to pay £60 million for a player that you apparently did not want, were annoyed at being linked to in the summer, but all of a sudden now he's key. And I question whether that's the player, what they saw, and if he's had such a great start for Sporting that they feel the need to buy him and they've reevaluated, or if this is another case of Ed Woodward jumping in on transfer signings that he didn't need to make.
Meanwhile, I think it might be a case of Ed Woodward, because I don't know that any player out of Ligue 1 should have such a massive transfer value. I mean, I know that we are talking about going to a Premier League team and going to Manchester United at that. But you saw the problem with Yao Felix early in the summer, who went for 126, and he's not found his feet. So I don't know about going from Ligue 1 to a bigger league if you can really justify massive transfer signings. One transfer that I did find quite funny was the current German champions, Bayern Munich, went and did a repeat of the Manuel Neuer situation from 2011-12, where they went and bought Schalke's new up-and-coming, incredibly talented-looking goalkeeper, who's a sweeper-keeper, in Nivelle. So even if Bayern doesn't win the title this season, that they've replaced Manuel Neuer.
And you kind of got to – they're sitting – I was going to bring that up. You know, it is interesting now. Two of the leagues that we didn't think that we were going to have transfer or title races in Italy and Germany, we actually have title races. You know, Bayern are sitting in third as the season starts again this weekend. And Juve are only 2 points ahead of Inter, Antonio Conte at Inter has just done amazing things. And
well, he's taking your Manchester United rejects, and he's brought
them into
the fold.
It's amazing what you can do with those players when you play in a league that just plays at a slower pace.
It's amazing what you can do with those players when you play them in a style that sort of fits them, I'd say. Because I don't think the Manchester United style fits Romelu Lukaku and Alexis Sanchez.
Well, Alexis Sanchez isn't playing. He scored and then went out with a hamstring injury, and then he came back and he hasn't played since. So that's a wash. Romelu Lukaku is the type of player who will do well in Serie A. And the game goes a little bit slower. He can use his power and speed that he does have a little bit more effectively. And when you look at how Ole Gunnar Solskjaer wanted to play and what he was looking to do and create off the counterattack and play with speed, that's just not what Romelu Lukaku is going to do at this point in his career. Maybe when he was with Everton, and certainly when he was on loan with West Brom and he was a little bit younger and probably a full stone lighter, that was where he was. But it's not where he is at this point in his career. And I think he'll do well to just score the goals and play well for Inter Milan.
I think you're right. He might be struggling for competition at the striking position in Belgium with Divock Origi, of course.
Well, I mean, it's a repeat of the situation about six, 8 years ago when they had Christian Benteke, who was being chased down by one young Romelu Lukaku.
I mean, six, 8 years ago they had Romelu Lukaku and Divock Origi chasing down Christian Benteke. And I remember in the game against the United States in the World Cup in 2014, was it?
Yes.
Belgium, United States. Divock Origi was slated to start. And that was the game that really got me on the Divock Origi loving train. And I've been on there ever since because he went to Liverpool.
Well, my Belgian
right
jersey is a Divock Origi jersey. I was trying to give it away for years, but now I think I'll keep it.
just to rub in the face of any Barcelona fan you come across?
Yeah, just a little bit. But so with the last 10 minutes, we can talk a little bit of MLS. Did you know that the MLS draft happened this last week?
Excuse me?
Did you know that the MLS player college draft happened late last week?
I actually did because a friend of a friend of mine was drafted to DC United.
Oh, I was waiting for you to say no, and then I was going to say no one else did either.
Well, I mean, the only reason I knew is because I saw on my friend, a friend of my friend got drafted. That's the only reason I knew that they had a draft recently for the MLS.
I have been on MLS for years about, you know, signing the big name European player and stuff like that. And this year thus far, it hasn't happened. You know, of course, LA Galaxy are in negotiations right now with Chicharito Hernandez. Or, I'm sorry, Inter Miami are negotiating possibly with Chicharito Hernandez to come over and play. But I've been banging on for years about, you know, why do you need to sign the big player? Why do you need to sign? And then I'm going through, and it's December, it's January, it's after the and I'm waiting, and I'm waiting, and I'm waiting, and I'm looking through the transfers that have been made, and I'm like, I have absolutely no idea who any of these people are. And I don't begrudge anybody who spends their time covering this. I'm just going to say, like, look, we watch a lot of soccer. We cover a lot of soccer. We pay attention to it. The fact of the matter is when you have a game of that magnitude and that's played on that scale, it is impossible to watch everybody. And since I don't spend the bulk of my time watching Second Division Venezuelan soccer, there are a lot of signings from MLS that are going on that I don't know because that's the players that they're bringing in right now. And I'm like, I have no idea who this is. And if you claim to know, I want to know how you claim to know because who watched this person play?
I mean, the only new players that I know that go into the MLS are the players that I've watched play at the University of Maryland. And of those players, not too many of them have really made any waves. So
that's why
I love
Philadelphia Union's philosophy on the draft now. They're like, get a first round pick and they trade it.
Sell the first round pick as fast as possible.
Sell it because they're like, look, and they have come out and said it on multiple occasions. We no longer see this as a viable tool for getting players.
I mean, because they're right.
Well, I guess that's
as much
a good
as
thing.
As much as I love and support the University of Maryland's men's soccer team, the best player that I've seen come out of UMD's program is a player called Alex Cornelli. He was a 6'6" center back that was named as the Big Ten Network's attacker of the month for attacker of the week for about 7 weeks in one season. So that basically tells you how many goals he scored from corners. And he went and he joined the Columbus Crew, and he's currently playing in their farm team. I think he's gotten traded away from the Columbus Crew into a lower division of US soccer. So,
I didn't even
sort
know
of,
you could do that.
So that's sort of the state of U.S. soccer. I know.
Well, I don't want to say. Well, I think that's the state of college soccer, and I guess it's
yeah.
a good thing that so many of the local clubs in MLS have developed scouting networks to the point where they're able to identify these players and sign them before they ever get to the college ranks. And now what you're having is basically either the guys that haven't signed or players who are late developers who are coming out. And mostly when the MLS teams look now, they're drafting more for depth. In fact, I struggle to think of the last player who made it to the U.S. men's national team hasn't played college soccer at some point. The only one that I can think of off the top of my head is Jordan Morris. But he had already been identified as a potential – and he did not sign a contract with Seattle Sounders and chose to play at Stanford before. But Jordan Morris is the only one that I can think of on the team right now that is at that level – having played college soccer?
I think, is Graham Zusi still playing?
He may still be playing.
Yeah.
No, he's not. I think he retired.
He might
but
have retired.
But that's a different generation.
He was another UMD graduate that played at the University of Maryland. But that was a completely
yeah.
different generation. So I see what you're saying.
You know, that was the guys that we're looking at now who are coming up have played with MLS their whole lives. And we've gotten better. And I guess that's credit to the fact that we can do that now. And proof that at least in some direction, U.S. men's soccer is heading in a positive direction in that we're identifying, cultivating, and getting talent into the system earlier than we have in the past, rather than waiting on them to get to the point where they're 22, 23, 24. You know, at 22, you're already, I would say, past the peak of your developmental curve. We know what you are going to be.
I think that
and
the only position that it's possible to be college soccer in is goalkeeper.
Goalie.
Yeah.
Goalkeeper. And
I can say that for a fact is because Zach Steffen, who is currently playing at Dusseldorf in Germany, played for the University of Maryland in 2012. And
the Philadelphia Union had the opportunity to sign him to a homegrown contract before he even went to the University of Maryland and decided not to do that. So that tells you why they hadn't won a playoff game up until this year. Well, we are up against it. Parting thoughts as you go out this evening. It has been a lot of fun, my friend.
Parting thoughts? I think that Liverpool's season this season, if anything, is being underrated. And that's coming from a very diehard Liverpool fan. I think that the shock of the season so far is the German title race, where there is still four or five teams in it. And what I'm most looking forward to seeing is, does Tottenham collapse in the league, or do they sort of try in the league? And will they go all out for the FA Cup, or will they leave the winning of a trophy for next year?
Will I see you on Sunday?
I think you probably will see me on Sunday.
Great. Save me a seat. I want to give a shout-out to Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland, Maryland's premier venue for live sports and entertainment and the home of the Premier League in Montgomery County, the home also of the DMV's biggest screen to watch live sports on. It's a great viewing experience. Come down and join us. As always, a big shout out to producer Paul. Thank you very much for keeping the trains running, sir. Big shout out to Armstead, even though he is not with us today. I hope you're feeling better, buddy, and I hope to talk to you next week. Thank you again, British Will, for filling in and joining us today. I look forward to spending some time with you this weekend. Why people still let me do that, I don't know. Anyway, it has been the end. It has been another awful show, and we'll try to do worse next week. I don't know if we quite reached our goal of creating the new worst minute, 90 minutes in sports, but we shall try. Once again, for Paul, Will, Armstead, Mike, this has been the Two Guys Soccer Show. We did pretty bad this week. We'll try and do even worse next week. Thank you, and have a good one.
Good night.